So I have an important message. A student came in just before spring break. I had a wonderful, long, meandering conversation, not about the class, just about life and things that were happening. And I asked him why he thought more students didn't come to see me. And he said, well, he thinks that a lot of us students feel that I'm intimidating. So here's my message. And to prove that I'm not intimidating, I'm going to show you some photos. Now, I want you just to think, can this possibly be an intimidating person? And onward. Well, that's me in high school. Well, I don't know, for a high school student, maybe a little serious getting. But shortly thereafter, that's my then girlfriend, now wife, Marcia. There I am in graduate school. Then this is, I was part of a men's group. And this was May in the High Sierras when I was still in graduate school. Now I'm at Wisconsin. That's how I looked when I first came here. And then shortly thereafter, with my older daughter. This is with a very distinguished group of philosophers and economists, a group of academics that I meet with that we've met every year since 1981 to discuss each other's work. That's the same group in 1999. And here I am with a bunch of students, you know, at a weekend retreat, which I do at the end of the semester for my upper-level courses and graduate seminars. We go off into the woods for a weekend. And this is me at in the Parliament Building of Taiwan during what was called the Sunflower Movement. I happened to be giving some lectures in Taiwan, and the students had and young people had occupied the Parliament. You know, it's like occupying Congress for an extended period of time to protest corruption and various other issues in Taiwanese politics. And I was escorted in, and they wanted to have a seminar with me, a discussion about politics, democracy, and how they can connect to it. So we gathered in a corner of the Taiwan National Parliament and had this discussion. So, what's the implication? Come by to chat in office hours. And don't think that you need to have some big agenda. Just come and talk. I'd like to get to know you. I've been teaching for a very long time, and I absolutely don't plan ever to retire because I gain so much from knowing you. And I hope you gain from knowing me. So come by and talk. Okay, enough of that. Let's wrap up the last lecture. It was a little rushed at the very end. I want to just have a little slower discussion of the problem of affirmative action, because it is such a controversial and contentious issue. For good reason it's contentious. I'm not saying that the objections are, sort of off the wall and silly, but it's dealing with a really deep problem in our society. And the question is, what are the alternatives? And what are the positive aspects of affirmative action? And how should we really think about it? So first, just to run through again the objections, these I think are familiar. The most obvious objection is that affirmative action is a form of reverse discrimination. It unfairly puts white at a competitive disadvantage. Secondly, it creates resentment and white backlash, which ends up strengthening prejudice. That second objection is just an empirical one. The question is the backlash big enough to make things even worse than they were in the absence of affirmative action? And obviously, a policy which, no matter how well motivated and how justifiable on its own terms, if it actually ends up making things worse because of the backlash, well, then it's a problematic policy, even if it's a defendable policy. And the third standard objection is it just doesn't work. It doesn't actually reduce racial inequalities. This third objection is the weakest because the evidence from affirmative action is pretty unequivocal that it has worked in certain contexts. And when it is removed, as in college admissions in some places, inequalities increase. They don't decrease. But the other two objections are real and have to be taken seriously. But what's on the other side? What are the justifications? Okay, let me just run through then the kinds of justifications that people use for affirmative action. Now remember, just to put this back in context, we explored a whole variety of ways in which discrimination and disadvantage based on race continues to be operative in the present. It's not just something that happened in the past. It's an ongoing reality with real consequences in the lives of people, in which, therefore, if you object to discrimination, if you think this is a violation of certain core values, which our institutions ought to embody, then something has to be done. And affirmative action is one way of trying to deal with it. So what are the justifications? First, affirmative action is often defended as redressing past injustices of a group. This is kind of in the spirit of reparations, right? So if harms have occurred to a group in the past and there were no redress of those harms, then even if the harms aren't continuing in the present, there's an argument for reparations. That's a kind of a standard way of thinking about how you deal with past injustices. If there were no injustices in the present and it was only a question of dealing with past injustices, I think that would be a fairly weak defense of affirmative action. Because after all, people living today, if in fact injustice has disappeared, are not themselves responsible for those past injustices, and one therefore can say, well, why should people today be paying for reparations for past injustices unless there are legacies of those past injustices which continue to dominate people's lives today? And that then makes the second issue, I think, a more telling one, a more important issue, that this is a way of counteracting or neutralizing current forms of injustice, current forms of discrimination. And with respect to that justification, the question then is, are there alternatives which do as good a job in neutralizing current discrimination? I can tell you as a professor, and I'm on admissions committees and the like, the presence in the background of an affirmative action idea puts a lot of pressure on admissions committees to do their damnedest to find the very best possible minority candidates. It acts as an actual process of circumventing whatever discriminatory processes might be at work to beat the bushes, to really find affirmative, you know, to find the best candidates that you can. And it's certainly the evidence is that it does that for employers as well when there are conditions under which affirmative action is mandated. And what's the alternative to an affirmative action? Well, an alternative would be for people to take employers or universities to court for discrimination. But you can imagine that's an extremely problematic solution. How many people can afford to do so? And how can it possibly be the case that you could provide evidence of direct discrimination in any given case? Legal remedies through the courts simply aren't feasible. Counteracting and neutralizing current discrimination seems to me a legitimate argument to counterbalance against the arguments on the other side. A third argument for affirmative action, serving the needs of particular communities. Now, this is again an empirical case. If you want doctors and lawyers to particularly serve the needs of those communities, of African American and other minority communities, the evidence is unequivocal that you need more doctors and lawyers from those communities. If you have an all-white medical and legal profession, of course it wouldn't be all-white, but vastly disproportionately, those communities will be more underserved. So there's an argument based on the behavior of the graduates of programs, which says that you need, in order to serve the needs of various parts of the community, you need to have those parts of the community adequately represented among the students getting the credential. And that seems to me an entirely legitimate policy. It's an entirely legitimate purpose of medical schools to produce doctors that will actually serve communities. It would be, for example, if medical schools felt they needed more general practitioners, they needed more people to go into family medicine, rather than, as Tom Lehrer once said, he's a comedian of the 1960s and 70s, having doctors specializing in diseases of the rich, right? So if you felt you really needed more family practitioners, you might then on your admissions committee look for indicators that your prospective admittees to a medical school would be particularly tuned into the problem of family medicine. That would actually end up leading to a affirmative action for women, because women medical students are much more likely to go into family medicine than are men. Well, I think the same kind of argument can be used with respect to serving Native American, African American, and Hispanic and other minority communities. And finally, as a defense of affirmative action, it's valuable for everyone in an academic program to have fellow students from diverse backgrounds, that the diversity of the context of education is itself educational. There's hardly a discipline where that's more true than in sociology. In sociology courses where the stuff of what you talk about are things like race and ethnicity and problems of cultural variation in populations, to have such discussions within completely homogeneous populations, well, that limits the learning capacity of students, the kinds of dialogue and discussion that would occur. And more generally, then, a diverse student body is good for everyone, good for the majority population as well as minorities. All right, on to today's topic, this week's topic, gender. Well, of the various topics we're discussing, there's hardly one that has a more intimate relationship to all of our lives than gender, right? I mean, for most students in this classroom, when we discuss race, it's something I hope you find interesting and you do find relevant to your own life, even if you're white, because race and racism and the problems of living in a multiracial world, even if you're in the advantaged group, is a problem you need to grapple with. But it's not necessarily something which on a daily basis impinges on your life, but gender does. Gender is something that everybody embodies and lives. And therefore, it's, I think, of all the topics we're going to be discussing, the one that resonates most deeply with your own lived experience and with the dilemmas and constraints and possibilities that you're facing in your own lives, all of you. The study of gender is not just the study of issues around inequality and how this affects the lives of women. Of course, gender is a relation, and it's as much about men as it is about women. This is the a kind of way of introducing the general perspective. The first issue to deal with is the relationship between gender and nature. Aha, this explains our differences in salaries. Well, that's a pretty implausible account of how we end up in a world where men earn more than women, just taking a peek inside your diapers when you're a baby. Let's begin, as we've begun many of these discussions, with discussion of words, of concepts. What do we even mean by gender? Okay, The standard way that sociologists approach this is by drawing a distinction between a biological classification system and a social classification system. Sex is a biological distinction based on roles in the process of biological reproduction. Gender is a social distinction between the roles and expectations linked to sex. There was, in the Kentucky Derby, 10 years or so ago, a filly that was one of the top contenders. Rachel Alexander, I think, was her. I think that was the name of the horse. And when that race occurred, women were being interviewed around the country about what they thought about it. And the reporters sometimes referred to the gender of the horse. You know, and there were women who were interviewed who said, "Go, girl." Well, a filly isn't a girl horse. Girl is a social category. Filly is just a biological category. And horses don't have genders. They have sexes. Gender is a social category. It's a social distinction between roles and expectations, and you could add identities to bring in the more, you know, subjective internal experience of gender that are linked to sex. Gender is the social transformation of biological attributes, sex, into a social difference. And gender norms are the rules of appropriate behavior and social roles for men and women. So you can think of gender as a social process that transforms some raw materials. The raw materials are given by nature, but transforms those biological raw materials into a salient, publicly recognized social difference. And to say there are norms attached to this difference means that there are real rules that govern it. Remember at the very beginning we talked about sociology as the study of rules and how rules govern behavior. And one of the rules that's really salient in our lives and we've all internalized very deeply are rules around gender. To have rules means that there are sanctions if you violate rules. If you're a man and you behave like a woman, there are sanctions. People react to you. If you're a woman and you behave like a man, people react to you in a different way. They wince. They feel you're being too aggressive. I think that's one of the issues that was in play in the presidential election. When Hillary Clinton behaved in an aggressive way, it's not that she was being especially aggressive for a politician. If anything, on the spectrum of politicians, she was on the relatively mild side. But people were critical of her because she was a woman behaving in that way. And this constantly occurs in the micro settings, you know, in graduate school, in seminars. Men can get away with a certain kind of pattern of interruption in seminars. That's one of the ways in which gendered rules very subtly are different. The rules of interruption in conversations and seminars. Men can get away with things that it's much harder for women to. They're seen as interrupting when they interrupt. Now, in the present moment, 2017, compared to 1977, when I first began here, in 2017, men will get called on this. People are very much more tuned into the problem. There's an effort to tone down the interrupting behavior of men and to give permission for women to interrupt in a similar manner and to get a kind of humane interruption pattern. Interruptions aren't necessarily a bad thing. Interruptions are part of the give and take of conversation in which people are excited and engaged and thinking in terms of each other's thoughts and wanting to jump in to add something. So interrupting is okay. It just has to not have the character of pushing aside someone. And that aspect of interrupting turns out to be a gendered aspect. Well, those are norms. Norms mean if you violate the norm, there's some kind of sanction. One of the great achievements of the current period, I think, is that those norms are getting much weaker, much more fragile. You know, a man can be feminine in his self-presentation and in his way of relating to people without getting slammed and marginalized to a much greater extent today than in the recent past. And that's an achievement. It's an achievement to have a weaker set of gender norms. Well, all of this brings us to the question of what exactly is natural. So if we have this biological raw material sex difference, and we have this social process which transforms it in all these complicated ways into a social difference, well, there is, after all, some raw materials there. It's not just in the imagination of people that men and women biologically are different. What's the character of that difference, and how much does that constrain what this social transformation process does? So here's a way of thinking about it. This is an answer to the question, what's natural? Let's take one example that's pretty salient in a lot of places today. The difference between men and women in their underlying dispositions to be nurturing, to be caregivers. So a standard part of gender role differentiation is that women are the caregivers and men are the tough workers, right? So men occupy space in the public sphere. Women provide nurturance and caregiving labor in the home. And underlying that is often a view that there's an underlying biological difference in either the hormones or the neurological structure. You know, you can have different ways of trying to identify exactly where what the root in the biology is of this difference, but that women are by nature more nurturing and men are by nature more competitive, more aggressive. Sometimes male competitiveness is identified with the hormone testosterone. You know, and you see this, when you see a bunch of male politicians yelling at each other, sometimes it's described as testosterone-fueled conflict. And it is true, it's part of the biological difference between men and women, that there's a different distribution of testosterone in men and women, and a different distribution of estrogen in men and women. These are hormonal differences. It's important always to remember that what's different is the distribution, and the distributions overlap. There are women that have testosterone levels above the levels of some men, and there are some men whose testosterone levels fall into the typical range associated with biological women. Okay, so there's this general feeling that women are by nature nurturant and men are by nature aggressive and competitive. And this then is thought to, by many people, help to explain why women's actual behavior is more caregiving, which we observe in their taking care of babies and the elderly in particular. All right, so let's think about this. First, let's look at the existing distribution of caregiving behaviors. So we're looking from the outside. We're not plumbing the depths of physiology. We're just observing what people do. And what we're looking at is the number of women or the percentage of women who engage in high levels or low levels of intensity of caregiving behavior. And there will be some kind of distribution with a peak and then tails of the distribution. And if we look at the world in which we live, which is also a world with strong gender norms, rules that correspond to that behavior, the distribution for women would look something like that, and the distribution for men would look something like that. So the distributions overlap, but the technical term for that peak is the mode. It's the most frequent point. It's not the same as the median, which is the point in the middle of the distribution. Since these distributions are kind of skewed, the median and the mode won't be the same. So in the world with strong gender norms, there's a pretty big gender gap in actual observed caregiving. Let's take this to be the United States in 1955, you know, in the Leave It to Beaver era of the stable breadwinner, male breadwinner model with the domestic housewife, full-time caregiver. The distribution of caregiving
activity of actual behavior would look something like this. This isn't real data, I'm just drawing a picture to represent in a stylized way. Now let's think about what the hypothetical distribution of caregiving would be in a world with very weak gender norms. So now we're imagining a world in which it's perfectly acceptable for men to be stay-at-home dads, for men to be pushing a baby carriage or baby stroller to the park on a weekday morning rather than just on a weekend. So gender norms now are weak. They're not putting a lot of pressure on people to do one thing or another. Well, in a world with weak gender norms, the distributions are likely to look something like this. Now, the way I've drawn it, I'm assuming that there might still be some gender gap. If everybody was completely free, there were no sanctions, so male and female wages were just the same, so in a couple, there was no incentive for the woman to stay home and the man to go to work, because the family's economic situation wouldn't depend upon that. There were good social supports for caregiving, so it wasn't extremely demanding on a family to violate some earlier form. So this is a world where there's no real pressure on women to be the caregivers and men to be the breadwinners. Men can fully, freely, if that's the way they want to do it and they negotiate it and that's the way their family wants to live their lives, for men to be the baby tenders. So my assumption is, well, it's more than an assumption, there's good data to support this, that the gender gap in caregiving would be less in a world with weak gender norms than in a world with strong gender norms. I suspect my kind of underlying intuition is that it probably would not be the case that the gender gap would collapse completely on the caregiving side. I suspect that there are these underlying dispositional things that are rooted in hormones and in our neurological structures that would continue to produce a little bit of deviation, that there will be more men that will do less caregiving. If for no other reason, and this is a biological fact, this is not simply a social fact, it's easier for a single woman to bear a child and to go it alone than it is for a single man. So there will be more women who will have responsibilities over babies, if only because there will be some women who will want to do it without a partner. Whereas it's much more demanding, much more difficult for a man who doesn't want a partner and wants to be a father to get access to a baby, as it were. It's not impossible, and our society has figured out ways to make this possible. That's historically extremely novel, that to make it possible for single men to become fathers without spouses, without a woman as part of their lives, and to have that be a legitimate thing to do. It's rare even in our society, but it's possible now. And that very possibility reflects the weakening of gender norms. But still, my point here is, you don't have to believe that the gender gap in caregiving would collapse to nothing. There may be an underlying biological difference that will underwrite some difference between the observed behavior of men and women. But that difference, the overlaps will be huge, rather than the overlaps being small, in a world where the gender norms don't add that additional pressure on people. That's what it means to talk about the interplay between what's natural, what's rooted in the biology, and what's social, what's constructed by the conventions and social relations and power relations that shape our lives as gendered persons. Now let's look at the empirical story. Let's delve into the data. What's happened? The basic punchline is massive transformation in the course of three generations. Roughly speaking, if we want to talk about three generations, since the beginning, between the beginning of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. Massive transformations. The speed of transformation of gender relations is probably the most rapid, profound social change in world history, if you want to make a grandiose statement for which I don't have strong data to support. But it's arguably the most massive, rapid social change, certainly faster than the Industrial Revolution. The destruction of agrarian society and its replacement by a modern industrial society took much longer than the transformation of gender relations in which we're still living. There are seven important elements, I think. I mean, I'm sure you could add other things to this list. Seven elements that make up this historic transformation: legal rights, labor force participation, occupational structure and income, power, family structure, the domestic division of labor, sexuality, and cultural degendering. We'll go through each of these briefly. These are also, again, discussed in the book, so you don't have to frantically write down everything I'm going to say. The slides are available for review, and the book, of course, is available for more detail. Legal rights. Well, here's a list of legal rights gained by women in the 20th century. The most famous of these is the right to vote in 1920. Today, it's pretty hard to imagine that serious people, thoughtful people, could argue that adult women simply were not sufficiently rational to be given the right to vote. I mean, that very idea that there is a differentiation in our species between men and women that corresponds to a differentiation in their capacity for rational deliberation, weighing of pros and cons around political choices. And that also that women are so submissive that if you gave women the right to vote, you would be giving their husbands two votes. Those were the two arguments that were given. The subordination of women would render a violation of the one man, one vote principle, because some men, those with wives, would have two votes. But more basically is the argument that women simply were not rational. They were like children. Now, if you live in a world where that's the official constitutional view of women, and you're a woman, and you get that message, what do you think that does to your sense of self, right? It's fundamentally a humiliating view of your competence and capacities. Now, right from the start, there were women who objected to it. It's just a myth that women throughout American history until sometime in the 19th century simply accepted this submissive role and this status as an inferior person without full citizenship rights. No, women objected to it right from the start. And there are famous cases of women, Abigail Adams, and chastising her husband in the discussion of the Bill of Rights that women were denied full rights. There's famous accounts of this. But nevertheless, it was broadly accepted. Most women accepted this as the natural order of things, even if they also in their hearts felt there was something wrong with it. And it took until less than 100 years ago, less than 100 years ago, before women were deemed equal citizens. The equal right to divorce really only started in the 1940s. So that the grounds for divorce of a man were much easier than the grounds for divorce initiated by a woman. You know, in some parts of the world, that's still true. There's some parts of the world in which a man can, without question, get a divorce, and women have extreme barriers to initiate a divorce. Reproductive rights. Well, this is, of course, one of the most contentious features of legal rights. Reproductive rights were gained substantially in 1973, gained through a Supreme Court decision rather than through legislation, although there was legislative actions even prior to Roe v. Wade around reproductive rights. The rights of women to control and own their own bodies. and make decisions about their own bodies without the intervention of the state, without the state prohibiting them from making decisions about their own bodies. Reproductive rights, and the controversial aspects of that are most notably around abortion, but not only. Contraceptive rights are another issue. Access of women to contraception. It's still controversial among some groups that women, and particularly young women, should have unfettered access to control their own reproduction. Equal rights to university admissions. That's even later. Until the 1960s. It was perfectly fine for a university to discriminate explicitly, you know, not implicitly, to explicitly have higher standards for women to get in than men. Till the 1960s. That was not a violation of law until the 1960s. Equal rights to jobs also only occurred in the 1960s. You could have jobs that advertised men only can apply. Just like you used to be able to have jobs that would say whites only. Just for the record, there were times in American history where there were jobs that would have as part of their job description, Irish need not apply. I'm sure many of you have Irish ancestors. That was also a legally permitted target of discrimination. Equal rights to participate in sports only came in 1972. Now that's a big one, actually. I mean, it's not, I think, as important as the right to vote. I mean, if you want to look at the landmark decisions that opened up space for the empowerment of women and the erosion of this legal subordination, the right to vote looms very large as signaling the beginning of the end for legalized male domination. But the rights, the equal rights to participate in sports was also a pretty significant change, Title IX. It's what opened up the space for women athletes to have sports in which they could perform in universities, especially. That was the main target for this, was in universities. Now, it led to the demise of some male sports in universities, because the equal rights to sports meant that universities had to provide as many slots for women athletes as for men athletes, I suppose proportional to admissions or something. I don't know the details of the formulas, but equal slots. Well, there's going to be a big football program in an American university no matter what, and in most places a pretty substantial basketball program. But what do you do about baseball? Well, in the University of Wisconsin, softball replaced baseball. The university couldn't support both of them, because if it supported both of them, there'd be too many male athletes getting support. You couldn't have an intramural baseball and an intramural softball team. And that was one of the ways that the University of Wisconsin decided to create greater space for women athletes. Women's hockey came only after, not as a club sport or as a recreational sport, but as a serious sport only after equal rights in sports. There were lots of objections to this. It was fought. It was seen as harming men, because the idea was, well, that women just weren't as interested in sports as men. And because they weren't as interested, it was unfair to men to restrict the number of male sports in order to create more space for women's sports. But of course, one of the reasons women were less interested in sports was there was less opportunity to do sports. And one of the things you've seen is the ripple down effect of creating equal rights for sports in universities has had a huge effect on sports in high school. And the increased women's access to sports in high school has had a huge effect of sports for younger kids. And that required changes in rules, which have a kind of affirmative action character, right? This says, we're going to mandate the requirement that more resources be put into women's sports so as to change the rules of the game under which the whole culture of sports develops in a way less gendered way now than it was 40 years ago. Equal rights to participate in all military roles, that I believe was officially, it was announced earlier, but I think it went into force in 2016. So we're in the very early years of the removal of what probably is the last instance of legalized job discrimination, combat roles for women. And it's an interesting process. It's a very interesting process by which this has occurred. Because, of course, if you're going to have women in combat roles, they need to pass the appropriate physical tests. The same thing for women firefighters and for women police officers. There are physical standards, and men are stronger than women. That's a biological difference. But then the question is, what's the appropriate standard? So you can set the appropriate standard so high that relatively few women could ever pass it, but that might be higher than needed for the job. So how much is it actually the case that you have to be able to carry 200 pounds on your back, you know, for a mile or whatever? I don't know what the rules were, but some really demanding physical strength. How actually important is that for the role? It could have been set too high so as to make it impossible for women to fulfill the requirement. So it meant that there had to be a serious recalibration of what is the physical demands of this job. I know this was a very big deal for firefighters. Firefighters have to be able to carry out a person from a burning building, right? That is a requirement of the job. If you're going to be a full-fledged firefighter, you want to be able to go into a burning building and rescue somebody who is unconscious because of smoke. So you have to be able to carry a certain amount of weight. But what's the appropriate amount of weight to use as the standard for physical strength? So there's lots to be worked out once you open up employment structures. But a lot of those changes in the standards were beneficial to men as well, because it actually then opened up the jobs to a wider range of men who were better able to meet those physical standards once those physical standards were better calibrated rather than calibrated through mythical visions of what the job required. All right, that's legal rights. First big change, monumental change. And it's crucial because, not because in a certain sense the legal rights seem very formalistic, it's just the law, it's not how people live their daily lives, but it opens up space and it makes possible new kinds of struggles over further advances. Second issue, labor force participation. Now, what is meant by labor force participation is the participation of people in the paid labor force that is working for money. Taking care of your own children is work for sure, but it's not in the labor force. Here's a chart that maps out the changes since the end of the 19th century of married women with children under 6 and married women with children over 6 years old, the percentage of them that are in the labor force. And it's really, it's just one of these very striking time series. Until 1940, there was very slow change. Between 1910 and 1940, it just hovered around 10% of women with children in school were in the labor force. And even as late as 1950, it was only around 20-25%. Most women, the overwhelming majority of women in the 1950s, were stay-at-home moms when they had children that were still in school. Today, over 60% of married women with preschool children are in the labor force. Huge change. Occupational structure and income. So here's the graphs for people in selected traditionally male professions who are women. In 1930, 60, 90, 2000, and 2011. And in all of these, there's been a dramatic change, and the big change occurs after 1960. It's only because we have 10 fingers that we mark our calendars by decades. If we If evolution had given us six fingers, there'd be 12-year intervals. That would be the way we symbolically marked time. So that's why these are nice round numbers, except for 2011. You should never take too seriously when people talk about the differences between the 60s and the 70s, and that and the 90s. I mean, all of these are kind of arbitrary. I like to say the 1960s ended in 1973 or 4, right? And the 1960s only began in 1962 or 3. You know, the decade that we think of in the 60s of student activism, of the civil rights movement, of the turmoil on campuses, the anti-war movement, I mean, all of that. If you look at college campuses photos from 1960s, it looks very much like 1950, 1955. If you look at student campuses by 1965, they're beginning to look very different. That's a little side point. That's a side point that won't appear on the exam. I won't ask you, what's a decade, right? Okay, again. Starting in the 60s, this really sharp increase in the percentage of people in selectively male occupations. And note, because the earlier periods were so male-dominated, even if the entry of women into these occupations comes close to parity with men, there'll still be fewer men in the profession for a while. It takes a while for the generations, the earlier generation, to retire and leave the profession. And this is reflected in this graph, which is about admissions to law schools and medical schools. So by the current period, roughly 45% of students admitted into medical and law schools are women. 45%, it's very close to parity. But as you can see, only 35% of lawyers and physicians were women in that period. That difference, that 10% gap, reflects the legacy of earlier periods where women got the credentials, got the education to a much lower degree than men. And again, the really big leap in this case occurs between the 60s and the 70s. There's some improvement in by the end of the 60s, but the real jump, what's really happening, is something happens in the course of the 1970s and then continues. This is the percent of women in selected, highly gender-segregated jobs. So gender segregation continues. The expression gender-segregated jobs refers to jobs that are substantially disproportionately one gender or another. The expression doesn't indicate what the mechanism is. It could be self-selection. So you could have an employment category in which women and men would be equally welcome, but in which it's overwhelmingly one or the other just because of the preferences of people, or because there are barriers of one sort or another. So you see that there are some occupations which remain today extremely sex segregated, gender segregated, both male occupations and female occupations. The most high-status occupations of professions of doctors and lawyers have been the ones in which the gender segregation has declined. If you look within the medical profession, then you see the reproduction of gender segregation in terms of specialty. Pediatricians have a much higher concentration of women than neurosurgeons. And exactly why that's the case, whether it's because of just the preferences of women, because of socialization and culture to be concerned about children to a higher degree, or to see that as part of their identity in a caregiving way, or whether it's because the way those subspecialties are organized make it tougher for women than for men, or vice versa, is something that I don't have the answer to, what the ratio between self-selection and barrier, but people are doing research on such matters. Here's the wage change. There has been an improvement over the last 40 years in the ratio between the median wages of men and women. Today, women's wages are about 80%+ of men's wages. In 1973, they were in the lower 60% of men's wages. The improvement in the closing of the wage gap seems to have stalled out. People often argue that the big gains occurred earlier, and the big gains occurred in part because of the stagnation and decline of male wages, not just the rise of women's wages. There's a convergence that occurred. If you look between 1979 and 1995, the convergence that occurs is because male wages are declining and female wages are increasing. But one thing that's for sure is that the gap is smaller today than it was 40 years ago. Power. This is the percentage of corporate officers and CEOs that are women. In the Fortune 500 corporations in 1995, it was a nice round number, 0% of CEOs in the top 500 firms were women. Now it's 4%. Well, is that a big increase or a small increase? Well, 4% is not zero. And for CEOs, more than most other kinds of positions, this problem of the time lag is a big one. It takes, people become CEOs after being in a particular line of industrial sector or firm. It takes a while, you know, 15, 20, 25 years to get to the top of those organizations because of vertical promotions. So if there were virtually no corporate officers in those Fortune 500 firms in 1995, there wasn't a big pool of people to eventually get promoted into the ranks of the CEO. So there's been some improvement, but really when you look at this graph, the improvement is at best modest. In terms of Fortune 500 board members and corporate officers, it's still only around 15% or so are women. Elected officials. Again, we see improvement, but the improvement is from extremely low to just modest rather than really approaching parity. This is for the US House, the US Senate. I should update this for 2017 data, but I don't think it changed particularly dramatically in the last election. And the United States in these terms actually doesn't fare all that well. The US is not particularly a good performer in terms of women in the national legislatures. In Sweden, 45% of elected officials in the national parliament are women. In most European countries, it's in the 30 to 35% range. In Canada, a country very much like the United States, it's 25%. In the US, it's under 20%. Family structure. Well, family structure is another area in which there has been truly dramatic transformation in the last 50 years or so. This is the distribution of household types between 1940 and more or less the present. In the 1940s and 50s, I didn't label these. That's unfortunate. I will see to it that in the book there will be this chart appears in the book and it will be labeled. I will be sure to put the label on the slide before I put it online. The red line represents the nuclear family household, people living with other family members, a spouse and children. And the green line represents single-person households. So in the United States today, roughly a third of people live in single-person households. It used to be only 10%. This change in household type reflects changes in marriage patterns. This is the percentage of women aged 30 to 34 who have never been married. By 1960, that was only, it was under 7% of the population. Only 7% of women aged 30 to 34 had never been married in 1960. Now it's over 30%. This, of course, reflects, is part of a more general problem, a general process, which also is reflected in the divorce rate, which this is the number of divorces for every 1,000 marriages. Now, that means in any given year, you ask, how many marriages were there and how many divorces? This isn't quite the same as saying what percentage of current marriages will end in divorce, because for that data, you have to know, you have to wait till everybody dies from a given marriage cohort to know how many of those marriages lasted throughout the lifetime of the couple. So what's often referred to as the divorce rate is often taken to be an indicator. If everything remains constant, it would be an indicator. You know, if in this year there's 1,000 marriages and 500 divorces, so it's the number of this is the number of divorces per 500 marriages. In 1987, there were about 500 divorces for every 1,000 marriages. That makes it seem like half of all marriages end in divorce. But of course, you don't know what those new marriages are going to actually be like. They might well have lower rates of divorce. One reason why the divorce rate has actually gone down in recent years is because fewer people are getting married. You know, so if the only people who get married are people who have a higher confidence that they will stay married, then the divorce rate will go down. But not the separation rate for couples. So this is just of legal marriages. For those of you who are interested in demography, this is the kind of things that demographers worry about. We have people who cohabit for decades and are never married. Well, if you cohabit for 25 years and then split up, should that be called a divorce? Well, it doesn't get recorded as a divorce because there was never a marriage. It's a social divorce in the sense of the breaking up of a household that had constituted itself as a family, but it isn't a legal divorce because of the particular form in which it took. So that adds complication to all of these estimates. But the main thing to look at, the main message from this, is that marriage is a much less stable institution. Even given the fact that fewer people get married, it's still a much less stable institution than it was at the beginning of the 20th century, and even than it was in the middle of the 20th century. The percentage of births to unmarried mothers, another story of a similar sort, that it used to be that only 5% or so of all births were to unmarried women. In the recent past, it's hovering around 40% of all births are to unmarried women. And this is not merely a phenomenon among minorities. It's often thought of as a phenomenon among African Americans. It has always been the case that there's been a higher percentage of African Americans with single parents with births outside of marriage than among white women. But the rate of increase over time has been actually higher among whites than blacks. It's a common phenomenon among white women as well. The domestic division of labor. Well, here's some striking statistics. This is the time devoted per week to routine housework by mothers and fathers in homes with children. So mothers and fathers in homes with children, that's the most demanding context in which the division of labor is concocted, is constructed in the micro life of people in the privacy of their home. In 1965, on average, mothers did 19 times more housework than their husbands. On average, a bit over 30 hours a week of routine housework, cooking, cleaning, laundry are the main components of that compared to men. The ratio has dropped to 3.3:1 now. Note that it's dropped much more because of a decline in the number of hours that women do than an increase in the number of hours that men do. I think, this may seem like just being a sarcastic thing to say of sorts. I think it's an achievement of the women's movement of gender inequality that houses are messier now than they were 40 years ago. That's one of the trade-offs. If you want a more egalitarian distribution of labor in the household, you pretty much have to decide it's okay to be a little messier. There's a lot of very interesting research on this. It's sometimes referred to as the game of chicken. You know, the game of chicken is a game, it's an idea that was popularized, I think, in some 1950s movies. You have two cars racing towards each other, and the question is, who's going to swerve first? And if neither swerves, you have a head-on crash at 60 miles an hour. So somebody's going to swerve first, or they're both going to die. Who's going to swerve first? That's called the game of chicken. Well, there's a kind of game of chicken around the messiness of households. Men, if it is true that men tolerate more mess in general than women because of socialization, I find it really hard to believe that that's because of hormones. I think that's socialization. Women are trained and socialized to take care of their nests more than men are. And there's even in the certain kinds of masculine subcultures a kind of virtue to messiness. It's not just that they're less concerned about dishes piling up in the sink, it's a kind of sign of virility or something, I don't know what, to have mess pile up in the kitchen. Well, if the tolerance for mess is greater for men than women, and you're having this kind of battle of the sexes over the division of labor, and women give in because they just can't put up with the mess, you end up with an unequal division of labor. Well, that's why I think it's a kind of achievement of gender equality that houses are messier than they used to be. The ratio is still quite disproportionate for routine housework, but there's clear signs that we have a more egalitarian set of gender relations, even within this very micro setting of people's lives. Around childcare, the inequalities were never as big as they were for routine housework. But that's, of course, that time spent per week on childcare includes playing with children. It's not just the kind of work aspect of taking care of children. It also includes the joyful play aspects of taking care of children. And the general, fine-grained data on this indicates that particularly in the past, men did more of the playtime, sports and game playing with children, whereas the more routine childcare activities, which were more like routine housework, were the responsibilities of mothers. But there's no question that the male involvement in children has increased substantially. And it's increased not just because they play more. But note, and this is a kind of interesting feature of the current period as well, the number of hours per week that mothers spend with their children has also increased. This is part of a shift in terms of child rearing practices, which is referred to sometimes as intensive child parenting, in which parents feel much more concerned about the futures of their children in ways that make them feel they have to spend more time intensely doing things with their children. This is particularly true in middle-class households where the activity density of childhood has gone way up in the last 30 years or 40 years. And the irony is family sizes are smaller, but it's taking more parents' time. And that's because there are more after-school lessons, there are more activities, there's more tutorials, there's more all the things that an intensive parenting style demands of parents. So both women and mothers and fathers' time rearing children has gone up over the last 40 years or so. But it's gone up proportionally more for men, so the ratio is now closer to parity. Sexuality. Now, norms around sexuality are not the same as gender norms. So gender norms refers to the appropriate roles for men and women and the appropriate modes of kind of behavior and dress and so on of men and women. Sexuality refers, of course, to sexual preferences, orientation, to erotic fantasies, all the things connected to sexual relations. It's connected to gender. That's why sex and gender, sex meaning sexuality and gender, are often combined in various courses. You'll have a course that will discuss both gender issues and sexuality issues. But they shouldn't be collapsed into a single problem. There's been really dramatic change within a very compressed period of time around these issues of sexuality. The public support for same-sex marriages in the United States has gone up from 25% to over 55% in the space of just a couple of decades, two decades. Really astoundingly rapid social change in attitudes. These attitude differences are heavily age-dependent. This is the percentage voting in favor of same-sex marriage in the Maryland ballot in 2012. It's very rare in social science to see an age gradient as steep as this. You know, 70% of people between 18 and 29 who voted in that referendum in Maryland voted in favor of same-sex marriage, compared to just over 30% for people of my generation. This is one of the reasons why I think, regardless of what happens on the Supreme Court or anything else, same-sex marriage is going to be a stabilized social form. It's not going to be reversed, because that 70% of younger voters in 2012, they're not going to suddenly decide that same-sex marriage is illegitimate and should be reversed. When you think about social change in general, you have to think both about what's changed and how stable the change is. Is it likely that there's a ratchet, that once a change is achieved, it stabilizes? I think it's extremely unlikely that this would be reversed, that the same-sex marriage rules would be substantially reversed because of this age gradient. You know, these younger voters are going to become middle-aged voters, and it seems implausible that things could happen in their lives which would make them believe, no, we want to break up these families and prevent them from marrying. Here's a interesting restroom sign that I saw at the New School for Social Research, the New School in New York City, an all-gender restroom. I can't figure out what all these symbols exactly mean. I don't know what the woman with the floor-length dress, what that's supposed to symbolize. If anybody has any thoughts on what the icons represent, feel free to tell me. Okay, well, one more, cultural degendering. Look at these ads. These ads would have been unthinkable 30, 40 years ago. And this, this may be something that the women in the audience, you know, the women in the class may not be aware of, since you don't go into men's rooms in airports. It's now standard to find in public restrooms in the men's room, baby changing tables. And there's a move to make these required in all new construction. I have to say that it's only on rare occasions that I've seen men actually using them, but I have now. I can report having seen men using baby changing tables. I thought it was interesting in this picture that they showed a man in a wheelchair changing. I mean, there's a kind of really extra oomph to that message. And that, of course, would affect the height at which you would set the baby changing table, right? You need to set it at a height that a person in a wheelchair could actually change a diaper on that table. All right, well, I think that's a good place to stop. We've reviewed this trajectory of what's happened. Now the question is, how do we explain it, and what does the future hold? And we will explore those issues on Thursday. See you then.